May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. I'm James Stiller. I'm appellant Cookie Hunter's attorney. And if it please the court, I'll begin with a brief recitation of the facts of the case. On September 2, 2009, at about 10:30 p.m., Officer Dunning of the Smyrna Police Department pulled Mr. Hunter over for failing to use his turn signal. Dunning suspected him of driving under the influence, so he administered a limited field sobriety test, which Mr. Hunter allegedly failed. Mr. Hunter was then placed in the back of a police car and began complaining of having to use his insulin pump because he's diabetic. At the point at which he was finally allowed to access his insulin pump, he was somewhat in a panic state. He was afraid that his blood sugar had at that point risen too high, dangerously high. He was given access to his pump, though, and he began self-medicating with his insulin pump. Upon arriving at the police station, he was still having problems with his blood sugar. He would later learn that the insulin pump had become defective and, in fact, was recalled by the manufacturer. While at the police station and under video surveillance, Mr. Hunter was alleged to have become uncooperative, even combative. He allegedly kicked an emergency medical technician in the arm, injuring him. He was even tased in an effort to subdue him. Dunning acknowledged that Mr. Hunter was being captured on video, and Mr. Hunter requested a copy of that video footage in his Rule 16 discovery request and in his supplemental Rule 16 discovery request, and then finally in a subpoena ducis tecum. Officer Dunning said that he never received a copy of the discovery request from the state. Police basically allowed the video surveillance that was captured to be destroyed. Officer Dunning testified that the video no longer exists and that the digital video recorder essentially records the images and then overwrites itself after 28 days, unless they're preserved for some reason. Such video footage would have clearly shown Mr. Hunter's innocence with respect to the two lead charges of assault in the second degree and resisting arrest with force or violence.
How do we know that?
I pull that, Your Honor, from the testimony. Essentially, the video is going to show one of two things. It's either going to show Mr. Hunter on the floor in the throes of some sort of diabetic seizure, as his psychiatrist testified to, or it's going to show Mr. Hunter on the floor laughing and winking and smiling at the police officers, as Officer Dunning testified that he was doing. Now, Officer Dunning, in no place in the police reports or in the alcohol influence initial reports, mentions laughing, winking, or smiling. That only came out in testimony. Also, in the alcohol influence initial report, there's a block to be checked for laughing. That block is not checked. The blocks are checked under unusual behavior. There's a block checked for crying, for vomiting, and for fighting. But there is no block checked for laughing. So we believe that that video would have been case dispositive. If that video would have shown Mr. Hunter laughing and winking and smiling, that's proof positive that he was in total control of his faculties and that any of his actions would have been intentional. However, if that video would have shown him on the floor writhing in some sort of diabetic seizure, that would have shown him out of control. That would have answered the question of whether or not there were the elements of intent with respect to assault in the second degree and with respect to resisting arrest with force or violence. That's why we believe it would have been case dispositive, Your Honor.
But there was other evidence or lack of other evidence as well.
There was other evidence, lack of evidence, testimony. There was testimony of the emergency medical technician who was injured, and nowhere in his testimony does he say that Mr. Hunter was laughing, winking, or smiling. That was only Officer Dunning's testimony given at trial. Next, an expired blood test kit was used to draw Mr. Hunter's blood for testing. The expiration date on the kit was August 31st of 2009, and the test was actually done on September 2nd of 2009. That's when the blood was drawn. at least 2 days after the kit had expired. Using expired Vacutainer cubes in the blood test kit is in direct violation of the manufacturer's specification sheet. And the phlebotomist who drew the blood ignored the instruction sheet that comes with the kit. The instruction sheet says in plain print to gently invert the tube at least 5 times, and underneath that, in italics with an exclamation mark at the end of the italics, it says, do not shake the tubes vigorously. There was testimony of Officer Dunning that the tubes were shaken vigorously. Once Officer Dunning saw that his testimony was not helping the state's case, he did try to backpedal and change his testimony by demonstrating something other than shaking the tubes vigorously with his hands. The blood test has long been recognized as a scientific test.
So and, what, yes, Your Honor. Factual finding was made by the trial judge, if any, to allow admissibility in compliance with the instruction?
There was a motion to suppress, and there was a hearing on a motion to suppress. That was with respect to the outdated nature of the blood test kit. And there was testimony from the state DUI chemist that the kit being outdated by a couple of days really wouldn't matter. It wouldn't affect the test either way. The issue of the improper use of the blood test kit by the phlebotomist, that didn't come forth until trial. That's when we knew about that at trial. As well, the specification sheet directing that the Vacutainer tubes and that therefore the blood test kit not be used if it's outdated, that came forth after the suppression hearing as well. That specification sheet did. I'm not sure I answered your question, Your Honor.
Well, was an objection made because of the shaking of the tubes?
Yes, Your Honor. There was an objection. The objection was made for the improper use of the tubes. They were shaken. That objection was made shortly after that testimony was delivered by Officer Dunning. I believe the objection was made in chambers.
And the trial judge overruled it because?
He overruled it. He said he didn't think it mattered, I believe. Words to that effect. I don't remember his exact verbiage, but it should be in the transcripts.
Well, that's the ruling you want reversed, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. We want the
Well, don't you think you should be able to tell us what the ruling was?
Well, Judge Vaughn clearly allowed the test results to come in, and that went in front of the jury. He didn't rule against that.
I know, but with regard to the outdated blood test, you indicated the record reflects a state chemist said using it 2 days after the expiration date wouldn't matter. So we can look at the record and decide whether that was an appropriate ruling. Now,
yes, Your Honor.
You've indicated that the instructions for drawing the blood say don't shake it. The testimony is it was shaken vigorously. And
yes,
the question becomes, what was the basis for allowing blood into evidence that had been shaken vigorously?
I know the objection was made to it, but I don't know. I don't remember Judge Vaughn's exact verbiage with respect to that. I can tell you that when the state DUI chemist was on the stand testifying, and she actually saw a copy of the specification sheet, and she was actually directed to look at a copy of the instruction sheet directing the phlebotomist on how to draw the blood, she did comment words to the effect that she needs to reevaluate whether those factors could, in fact, alter the accuracy of the test. And that's in the transcripts as well.
And did she?
Did she go back and look at that?
Did she reevaluate it and come back and say it matters or doesn't matter?
She never reevaluated and came back during the trial. No, Your Honor, she did not. She said that's something she has to go back and evaluate.
Well, with that remark then, what is the evidence that would support admissibility if she says I have to think further?
I don't think there would be any evidence that would support admissibility into evidence, Your Honor. And that's why I felt we had a strong argument to go ahead and get that evidence suppressed.
Well, yeah, our dilemma currently appears to be Judge Vaughn must have thought it didn't make any difference and must therefore have made a specific factual finding to support his conclusion that that reevaluation was not necessary.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't remember any particular verbiage that Judge Vaughn made with respect to that factual finding.
Well, put aside particular verbiage, did he comment on it at all when he denied your application to suppress the blood test at trial?
We were in a chambers conference about it, and I moved that it be suppressed because the kit was used incorrectly. And as I recall in chambers, he said, I'm not going to allow that, or words to that effect.
Well, surely the chambers conference was transcribed.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes, sir. It's in the transcripts.
Okay.
Okay. As I mentioned, the blood test kit has long been recognized as a scientific test, an accurate method of detecting alcoholic content in the blood. This can be seen in State v. Cardona. But this method can only enjoy the imprimatur of scientific credibility if it's repeatable. In fact, any test that is scientific has to have the element of repeatability in the test. Otherwise, it's no longer scientific. Anything less than repeatability in a scientific test basically negates the science to the test. The manufacturer of the Vacutainer tubes provided in the kit, that's Becton Dickinson, tells us in its specification sheet for the tubes not to be used if they're beyond their expiration date. The manufacturer further states on that sheet that underfilling the tubes will result in inaccurate blood to alcohol ratio and may lead to inaccurate or incorrect analytic results. Underfilling results from a diminished vacuum. That is the reason why Becton Dickinson says don't use them after their expiration date, because the vacuum on the tubes is designed to draw in a precise amount of blood. That precise amount of blood is supposed to mix with 100 milligrams of sodium fluoride, which is a preservative to keep the blood from fermenting and generating its own alcohol. And there's also 20 milligrams of potassium oxalate in that tube. That's the anticoagulant to keep the blood from coagulating. Obviously, if we draw in less amount of blood than the manufacturer determines is appropriate, we're still having the same amount of chemicals having a more adverse effect on the blood. The instruction sheet that comes with a blood test kit directs the phlebotomist who draws the blood in italics, as I already mentioned, to not shake the tubes vigorously, but rather to gently invert them at least 5 times. Shaking the tube vigorously before the anticoagulant has had a chance to mix with the blood produces thousands of tiny bubbles in the blood that form microclots. Now, the reason we don't want a clot in a blood sample, say, for example, we have a volume of blood, 1 part alcohol, 9 parts blood. If 2 parts of that blood clot, alcohol always follows liquid. That was in the testimony. If 2 parts blood clot, then you now have the same part volume of alcohol, but with 7 parts of blood. So you're going to get an elevated blood alcohol content reading.
Well, how yes, are we to deal with this? As I understand your argument, the manufacturer says you must do A, B, and C to get a reliable result. The state chemist says you really don't need A, B, and C. You can get a reliable result based upon what we have here, notwithstanding the shaking, notwithstanding the amount of the blood, notwithstanding the expiration date. And then the trial judge, this is at A17, says, I'm persuaded that the kit in this case worked appropriately and that the results produced are reliable. So you've got a factual finding of the trial judge supported by the testimony of a chemist that basically override the instructions from the manufacturer. So what are we supposed to do with that? Isn't this a factual issue?
It is, Your Honor, and there are two ways I want to answer that question, or there are two answers to that question. First of all, the state DUI chemist does not even have a degree in chemistry. I asked her that on the stand. She has a degree in other areas. But with respect to the other part of the question you asked, Clawson v. State pretty much answers that for us. In Clawson v. State, it recognized the importance of complying with the manufacturer's instructions when it comes to scientific tests. Clawson endorsed the bright line rule first established by the Superior Court in Holland v. Bochelle, which required a 20-minute observation period prior to the beginning of the Intoxilizer 5000 test. Again, the manufacturer there required the person to be monitored for 20 minutes before the test began to make sure they didn't belch, burp, or vomit. And in Clawson, the court endorsed that bright line rule and said, if the manufacturer of this scientific test basically says we can't do that, or we need to follow these steps, then we need to follow those steps. Otherwise, we can't rely on the evidence produced.
No matter what
essentially.
The state chemist says.
I would say no matter what the state chemist says, Your Honor. Yes.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to go back for a minute to your the assault and resisting arrest argument.
Certainly.
You told us that there was essentially a 28-day window during which the videotape would have been preserved.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was your discovery motion served and filed within that 28-day period?
No, Your Honor, it was not. I wasn't brought into the case until it was beyond that 28-day point. And we, as soon as I was brought on board, we immediately filed a discovery, Rule 16 discovery request. We followed that up with a supplemental request, and then, of course, we filed a subpoena.
You're saying that the police during the 28-day period were not on notice that this videotape might be the subject of a discovery request?
We had not put them on notice, Your Honor, but it's my understanding after teaching for 2 years electronic discovery at Wilmington University that any type of electronic evidence that's produced, when a person anticipates litigation, they then have a duty to preserve that evidence. The police are experts in evidence collection. They're trained in that.
You're saying that the police should be presumed to have been on notice even though they weren't on actual notice?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They're highly trained in evidence collection. What we have to ask ourselves there essentially is it more likely that the police, who are highly trained in evidence collection, would have been so grossly negligent as to allow a monumental piece of evidence, such as a video of two felonies being committed in the police station, to be destroyed? Or is it more likely that the officer decided that the video did not comport with his version of the events and therefore, through an act of omission, decided to do nothing and allow the videotape to be
overturned? Do we actually have only those two options from which to pick? Why would someone have to conclude that the police intentionally destroyed it or allowed it to be destroyed, knowing that it would be potentially helpful to the defense? Why do we have to reach that conclusion?
You don't, Your Honor. The other conclusion would be that they were so grossly negligent as to allow a piece of evidence that would have supported their case and allowed them to go into court and have testimony saying the camera was working and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, here's the video. Here's Mr. Hunter.
Perhaps more to the point.
Yes, Your Honor.
When did the Attorney General's office become involved in this case, elevating it from a potential JP court trial for driving under the influence to a two felony indictment?
It's my understanding he was charged with those offenses from the outset.
Well, in this case, the court did give a Lolly instruction. And so that's correct, isn't it?
It's my understanding it was a DeBerry instruction, as Lolly, of course, addresses evidence that the police should have looked for, and DeBerry addresses evidence that they did at one point in time possess, and then it no longer exists for some reason.
Right. But if you...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
The Lolly opinion...
Yes, Your Honor.
...is the progeny of DeBerry...
Yes, Your Honor.
...and contains the instruction that should be given. However you want to characterize it, the jury was instructed in this case that if the video was available, it would be favorable to your client. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
My question is, why was that not an adequate remedy?
Because in Johnson v. State, which I believe, Your Honor, you wrote the opinion on, Johnson v. State states quite succinctly that if the evidence that the police have destroyed is case dispositive, prosecution cannot go forward. And that videotape would have shown one of two things. It would have shown Mr. Hunter conscious and doing what he was doing. Or
going back to DeBerry,
yes,
in other words, you're saying that any secondary evidence would have been inadequate, and that in the absence of the video, the prosecution for these two felonies should not be permitted.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Can I go back to my question?
Certainly, I apologize.
I didn't get an answer.
Yes, Your Honor.
I asked you, when did the Attorney General's office become involved? And you answered that he was charged from the outset. But that doesn't answer my question. My question is, when did it go from a JP court potential driving of the influence case separated from the two felonies to being reviewed by the Attorney General's office rather than being prosecuted in part by the police? When did the knowledge of this incident first come to the attention of the Attorney General's office?
I do not know. I do know that when Mr. Hunter retained me to represent him in this matter, he at that point in time was charged with the failure to use a turn signal, the assault in the second degree, the resisting arrest with force or violence, and driving under the influence, Your Honor.
Was he indicted when you came into the case?
I would have to review the paperwork and supplement the record to give you an answer on that,
Well,
Your Honor.
If he were indicted within 28 days of the arrest, whether that's likely or not, given today's just processing of cases, that would suggest clearly that the AG's office was involved. I'm trying to get fixed on the date where someone other than the police would be attentive to what evidence might exist before they went forward with charging an individual and could have interrupted the 28-day disruption period or whatever it may be at Smyrna PD.
Yes, Your Honor. I have no information from the Attorney General's office or the police indicating at what point in time they became aware of that video being in existence.
Well, I'm not even concerned about when they became aware of the video's existence.
Yes,
I'm concerned about when they got involved in charging mode and started investigating the extent to which there would be charges and how the charges would be worded. There would necessarily have been some contact with Smyrna PD and understandably some suggestion to Smyrna PD that all evidence you have in support of these charges should be preserved. Logically, you would think the AG's office would want to see that evidence before they opted for assault in the second degree as opposed to assault in the third degree, just by way of example.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There was testimony from Officer Dunning where he said that he did not receive any discovery requests from the state. So I can say that at least Officer Dunning said that he did not receive any discovery requests from the state, which, of course, would have led us to know at what point in time at least he, a member of the police department, was put on notice.
Well,
I'm not sure if I'm
answering it at that. I'll sort through it myself.
Was it addressed before with the chemist, the expiration date and the purpose of having an expiration date with regard to the chemicals themselves? I understand the chemist said that this is all related to the vacuum, but I'm looking at the instruction sheet that says storage, and it talks about the storing the tubes at a certain temperature. It talks about the liquid preservatives and anticoagulants, their color or whether they're clear. It says don't use them if they have a different color. And then ultimately it says do not use tubes after the expiration date. That would seem to suggest that this has nothing to do with vacuum. It has everything to do with the chemical reaction.
That would absolutely suggest that, Your Honor.
But that's not what the chemist said.
No, it's not, Your Honor. The state DOI chemist said that this all revolves around, or the expiration date, if you will, addresses the vacuum within the tube. And she said that as long as she has enough blood in that tube, and she didn't really say what constituted enough blood, she goes ahead and finishes the test.
What's her basis for saying that?
I can't tell you what her logic was in saying that, Your Honor. I did attack her credibility on the stand, and I brought out that she doesn't have a degree in chemistry. She may know how to run the tests against the samples, certainly. She can be trained in that. But I don't think she understands or understood the science behind the test. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, the typical response is, I'm the state chemist and you are not. Any further questions?
Yes, Your Honor. Looking next at the video that was taken, again, we've got the video being destroyed, and I think that videotape, I'm quite convinced that if a picture paints 1,000 words, a video must paint 1,000,000. And I believe that that video would have shown...
You're just restating your position that the video would have been determinative either way, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
We understand that.
Very well, Your Honor.
And I should tell you that regardless of the fact that you're looking at a green light, the reason you are is because I neglected to turn your time on early enough, and you're now about to enter your five-minute rebuttal. Despite the green light, so you can decide whether you want to sum up briefly now or save your 5 minutes.
I would like to continue and go ahead and sum up if I could, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to the blood alcohol test, the kit was used incorrectly. It was in violation of the manufacturer's instructions. As well, the kit was expired, which is in violation of the manufacturer's specification sheet. Therefore, I would respectfully ask this honorable court reverse Mr. Hunter's conviction of driving under the influence and issue a bright line rule, as they did in Clawson, whereby if an outdated kit is used or if a blood test kit is used incorrectly, the results of that kit cannot go forward to the finder of fact. With respect to the videotape and the two lead charges of assault in the second degree and resisting arrest with force or violence, I would respectfully ask that this court reverse Mr. Hunter's convictions on those charges, as the videotape was most certainly case dispositive, and in accordance with Johnson v. State, if the evidence that the police destroy is case dispositive, prosecution cannot proceed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, I'll try to answer a couple of the questions that were posed. The first question was, or one of the questions anyway, I don't know if it was first, was about when the state may have become aware of what was going on in this case in the Superior Court as opposed to the JP Court. The docket sheet, which doesn't completely answer the question, at A1 of the appellant's appendix, indicates date of arrest was September 2nd, 2009. The case is accepted in the Superior Court September 14th of 2009. And then the next entry indicates that there was an indictment on October 5th of 2009. So it looks like the indictment was after the 28 days, but it does look like the case, at least in the Superior Court, was in the Superior Court. Doesn't really answer the question, I guess, of exactly when the state would have had knowledge of everything, but presumably sometime before October 5th, since that's when the indictment was handed down with the grand jury. The other question that was asked, I think by Justice Ridgely, concerned the trial judge's ruling on the issue about whether the blood sample was or was not shaken vigorously and what effect that had. It looks like in the appellee's appendix at B34, there's a motion for a judgment of acquittal at the end of the state's case in chief, and it's a motion for judgment of acquittal as to all of the charges, and the court's ruling, I think, on this is at B35 of the appellee's, the state's appendix, and the judge just simply says, this is looks like page 154 over on the left-hand side. It's one of these four-in-one formats. The court says, all right, thank you. I am satisfied there is sufficient evidence on each of the charges presented by the state. So the motion for judgment of acquittal is denied. So that's
Mr. Williams,
the extent of it.
Helpful. Thank you. And do you have any idea where this office conference transcription can be found in the record?
I think that is the what they're referring to. I don't know that there's a Let's see if it's a...
We were told there was a motion to exclude the blood evidence based on the shaking, and that that was addressed in an office conference. Did you run across that in your review?
I don't see that. It looked to me like it came up with the defense motion for judgment of acquittal. That's the first time I found it in transcript, and that's at the end of the state's case in chief. And then the defense does present some evidence of the defendant's psychiatrist, Dr. Villabona, then testifies after the court makes this ruling. But that's during trial. Page B33, it looks like it says courtroom 7 over on page 147, so I'm assuming they're in court and not in chambers or anything. So it looks like this is transpiring in court.
So you're saying that the record doesn't disclose the judge's reasons for allowing the blood test results into evidence?
Well, it doesn't say specifically. I mean, I'm assuming that you can infer that he thought that that was a sufficient basis to admit.
Other than that, he
doesn't make a specific factual finding, no.
So what we may have been looking for, at least what I would have been looking for, was a specific factual ruling about why he would accept a non-chemical expert testimony over that of the manufacturer about the efficacy of the test that the manufacturer created and marketed, but he made no such specific finding.
I didn't find any, Your Honor. I don't know
from the record what trumped the manufacturer's idea about the efficacy of the test through the testimony of the employee of the state chemist's office.
No, I think it must be on the basis of the testimony of the state chemist. She testified that when she looked at the sample, there was nothing unusual about the sample. She testified that she has done, I think, 1,500 of these blood tests. She does the alcohol blood testing for Kent and Sussex County. She said it appeared perfectly normal. It was unclotted, which I guess was the other issue about whether the anticoagulant was mixed or not. And she saw no reason not to proceed with the testing. That was her testimony. So I think on the basis of that evidentiary record, that was why the judge ruled the way he did.
So does this mean if a state chemist comes in and testifies that all of these instructions of the manufacturer, they're guidelines and they're really not necessary, that the tests will always be admissible then? As long as a state chemist comes in and says that the instructions of the manufacturer don't matter?
Well, I don't know. It's always going to be admissible, but I think that's certainly something the judge has to consider. These are evidentiary rulings the judge is making, so he's going to look at what evidence is before him.
I get to that in this case. Did the state chemist really address both issues? We have a record that says, from the manufacturer, don't use my kit after it's expired, and don't shake the blood. And then the state chemist says, well, looked okay to me, and I did the test, and the test should be admitted. How do we get there?
Well, I think Your Honor is probably right. It looked to me like what the state chemist was really addressing was the sufficiency of the Vacutainer tube vacuum. Now, she mentions the other things, that the blood appeared perfectly normal. She doesn't, and she wasn't asked, and she did testify after the officer, who was the person who agreed with defense counsel's characterization, that the tube was shaken vigorously. She wasn't asked specifically, well, what happens if you did shake, or the phlebotomist who made the blood draw at the hospital, if she had shaken this vigorously? That question was simply not asked. So there wasn't a direct response from the chemist, but the chemist did say that it appeared perfectly normal and that it was unclotted, which I guess would be the telltale signs if there was a difficulty with the mixing of the chemicals that are already in there with the blood taken from the accused.
This isn't meant to be a facetious question, if it may sound like one, but you indicated she testified she had performed this test 1,500 times in the past.
Yes.
Did she testify how many times she perform the test with an expired kit as opposed to with a manufacturer's blessing kit, so to speak?
I don't know that she gave a number. I think she said that she had seen some expired kits, and she also testified that she had done some retests. The individual for years who did a lot of these tests was a person named Dave Sockrider, and he retired a couple of years ago, and Deborah Louie has taken his place, at least as to the Kenton-Sussex test. And she said that I guess because she was going to come in and testify for some of the analyses that Mr. Sockrider had done while he was still employed by the state, she had done retests of specimens that Mr. Sockrider had tested previously. And what she said was that most of the cases, there really wasn't any difference or any appreciable difference in what her result was later on and when Mr. Sockrider had done it. So I think that's about the state of the record. There are a few cases I was able to find that actually deal with this issue about the expired kit. There was a 2007 Florida Appeals case, I believe it's pronounced Bruch, B-R-U-C-H. The kit was used there 28 days after the expiration. The Florida court said that was all right because there was no other indication that there was any impropriety. And there are two older Minnesota Court of Appeals decisions. There's one, Cardill, I believe it is, where the kit was used almost 4 months after the expiration date. The Minnesota court said that was all right under those circumstances. And the oldest case is a 1986 decision I found also from the Minnesota Court of Appeals called Palmer. And in Palmer, the kit was actually used about 14 months after the expiration date. The Florida case was a manslaughter prosecution, and the Minnesota cases were both driving under the influence DUI prosecution. So there is at least some case law from other jurisdictions dealing with the issue of whether the expired kit is determinative or not.
Do those states also have the standard that we set in the intoxilizer cases to say that there is a bright line 20-minute wait rule before the intoxilizer results can be admitted?
I don't know if they do or not. I think that's accepted.
How do we deal with that sort of uncomfortable fact here, that there's a case that says bright line rules apply to manufacturers' designated operation of the test when it's an intoxilizer? What's the rational, reasonable difference between that and the blood test?
Well, all I know is that with the 20-minute wait period that's discussed in Clausen, excuse me, the reason you have that is because you want to make sure everything is out of the person's mouth. And I know, because I've seen people do it, that if you gargle with mouthwash that has some alcohol in it and immediately blow into the intoxilizer without waiting the 20 minutes, you'll just get some crazy result that shows you should be dead. You know, the alcohol reading will go sky high. So the thing doesn't work right unless you have the 20-minute wait period. The question about the Vacutainer tube, I think, deals or the warranty, which is really a warranty from the manufacturer to the purchaser, it's a sales warranty in actuality, has to deal with the fact of whether the rubber stopper at the end of the tube that keeps the vacuum in the tube, so there's a vacuum to draw the blood out of the suspect, whether or not that's going to degrade, and apparently it can degrade over time.
The problem for us, though, is the bright line test is understandable to everyone. Here, it expired for 2 days, and the testimony is fine. But, you know, it's just like your first year of law school. What about 15 days? What about 30 days? How do we decide? The manufacturer said, don't use it after it's expired. And yet, we're supposed to say, well, it's okay if you use it after it expired. What's the time frame after it expired in which it's acceptable to use it?
Well, I guess the Minnesota court said 14 months. Florida said 28 days.
So we don't know what kind of professional testimony they had in their record. No, what we know here is that we have a state chemist who isn't really a chemist, who says close enough for government work, works in my office.
Well, I think her basis for saying that, she didn't exactly say that, but what she said was if the rubber stopper had degraded, you wouldn't have the vacuum and you couldn't even draw the blood out. So that was the telltale thing, I think, was does it work or doesn't it work? Well, it works if there's a sufficient vacuum to pull the blood out. She did testify at her later trial testimony. She was the only witness at the pretrial suppression hearing that you need to have at least 2 milliliters of blood, and she said there was a sufficient sample here to test. So apparently the
how do we reconcile that with the context of this instruction, do not use after the expiration date? It's in a paragraph that's talking about the chemicals and the anticoagulants and the color. It says do not use if the color is changed because there's a particular chemical that's yellow. And then it immediately says do not use after the expiration date. Doesn't that context say that it's the chemicals and anticoagulants are not reliable after the having nothing to do with the vacuum?
No, I think, and that may be, you know, the manufacturer's warranty, but the testimony was that there wasn't anything unusual about this blood sample, that it wasn't clotted, that it appeared perfectly normal, that it wasn't a strange color or anything. So I think what we have in the record is, at least, that this was a perfectly normal sample that was susceptible to testing, and that's what she did. And we're talking about a period of 2 days here.
Well, if the manufacturer had sent a representative that said, do not use this, this is not reliable, and the chemist says, oh, it's okay, can the trial judge accept the chemist over the manufacturer?
Well, I don't know. That's that's the battle of the experts that we frequently have at trials. The one person comes in and says he's crazy as a bed bug, and the other person comes in who's also a PhD psychologist and says, no, he's, you know, he has problems, but he was lucid when this happened. So you just have a battle of the experts. Those are factual issues that have to be resolved.
We also have what appears to me the fascinating anomaly that the Smyrna Police Department regularly erases their tapes within 28 days like proverbial clockwork, yet they don't take the time to look at their chemical test to determine whether it's expired or not and reach in the drawer and get one that hasn't. Does that make any sense?
Well, it doesn't make much sense to me, and I did go up to the Smyrna Police Department and looked at how this taping all works, and it's changed now, I can tell you that, and why you wouldn't save that tape is beyond me. That the tapes I've seen with DUI stops that are done from the police car, that's the best evidence you're going to have, because regardless of what that person says on the stand, when the jury can see of the drunk carrying on and not following instructions and wandering away and everything, that's great evidence. And why you wouldn't save that, I don't know. But
do you agree that it's dispositive?
No, it's not dispositive. And the reason it's not dispositive is because the defense here was not that I didn't do any of this, I didn't resist arrest, and I didn't kick that EMT. The only defense that was asserted to those two charges, the second-degree assault and the resisting arrest with force or violence, was that he lacked the mens rea, the specific intent, that he was acting involuntarily, and that's what his psychiatrist said. He didn't really, he wasn't asked the proper way, but that's what the psychiatrist said. He wasn't asked to give an opinion to a reasonable medical certainty.
The police said he was laughing, smiling, and totally in control.
Yes, and the EMT said he was lucid and was answering questions. And
so if we have this direct conflict between the people who were present, why wouldn't the tape be dispositive?
Because what the tape's going to show is, presumably, if the testimony's all accurate, is that he did resist arrest and that he did kick the EMT. I mean, the EMT has to go to the doctor the next day, and he eventually has surgery and he's out of work for 6 months. There's no doubt the EMT's severely injured by this, and that's what elevates it to a second degree assault. So that all that objective evidence is not really being disputed by Mr. Hunter. What he's saying is, well, you know, I was just acting involuntarily. The psychiatrist said, yes, if you tried to restrain him because of his PTSD and his combination of that with his juvenile diabetes, that he would do whatever he needed to do to try to get free. And that's not going to be answered by looking at the tape. I mean, the tape's going to show his physical actions, but he's not denying those physical actions. He's saying, it's what's inside my head, and that's not going to show up on the tape. I mean, there's testimony that he was laughing and winking.
And, you know, had facial expressions that indicated that he knew exactly what he was doing, and he was doing it intentionally. That would show up in the tape, wouldn't it?
Well, I had the prosecutor go stand in the room where it was, and I looked at the tape back in the control room, and you can see the face. So I assume you could, you know, you could see somebody laughing or even winking.
Right. So the tape might confirm what the police officer testified to, or it might show that Mr. Walker was having a or Mr. Hunter was having a seizure of some kind. And really wasn't in control of his actions, even though his actions did result in injuring somebody.
Well, there was no testimony that there was a seizure, and the concern was that Mr. Hunter was lying on the floor, and he was even banging his head on the wall at one point, and he said he was going into diabetic shock, and that's why the ambulance was summoned. That was the concern of the police, and then they take him from the Smyrna police station down to Dover to the hospital, and the blood draws actually done at the hospital.
I don't think you're answering my question.
I'm sorry.
The tape would have shown the opposite of what the police officer testified to, would it not?
No, I don't think the tape would have shown the opposite. I think the tape
would only show it would only show evidence favorable to the police side of the issue.
Well, I think it would show, I don't think it would show anything different. There wasn't any testimony that he was.
How do you know that, and how are we to accept that?
Well, I think that's what the EMT said who was there, and that's what the police officer who testified said. So you have two eyewitnesses who were there, and that's what they said. That's what they observed Mr. Hunter doing. The police officer testified he was combative, and the EMT said, yes, you know, he was combative with the police.
So we're being asked to accept as a legal matter the testimony of the police officer, even though the objective evidence, if there were any, would have could possibly have shown the contrary.
Well, that was not a claim the defense has ever raised. The defense has never said, I didn't do this stuff. You know, I didn't resist arrest, and I didn't kick the EMT. The argument is that I wasn't in control of my actions, that it was an involuntary thing.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, is whether there was conscious control or whether the actions that were taken, you know, were, you know, the result of some involuntary bodily phenomena. I understand that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, you know, the tape, I don't know that there's any indication that the tape would indicate anything different than the trial testimony of the two eyewitnesses. Mr. Hunter.
And there's no indication that it wouldn't either.
No, but
whatever anybody says about this tape, which none of us have seen, is speculation.
I mean, Officer Dunning never saw the tape either, you know, and he was the arresting officer and one of the trial witnesses. But the importance of it in terms of Johnson is whether or not it's case dispositive evidence, and it wouldn't be case dispositive in this case because the defense asserted was that I lacked the specific intent, the mens rea, not that I didn't do these things.
Okay, maybe I can get at this a slightly different way. As I understand your position, it is that nobody, including the defendant, ever said, no, I didn't struggle, I didn't fight or whatever, which would have shown on the tape if he had, right?
Correct.
Or if the tape still existed. So everybody's in agreement as to basically what his conduct was. The issue was whether that conduct was voluntary and knowing, or whether this was the conduct of somebody who was in some sort of psychological state of panic or whatever it might have been, that that he really couldn't control what he was doing. That was what the defense was, right?
Correct.
And if I understand you, your argument is that the tape wouldn't really show very much, if anything, as to what was going on in his head, even if it suggested that, yeah, maybe he did seem a little out of control, or, yeah, maybe he did seem to be mocking us and you know, totally with it, because what really needed to be found out was what his mental state was, and that's not necessarily observable.
Yes, I think that's correct. That's the problem, is you don't know whether he's posturing or that's what occurred. And the court did give the Lolly missing evidence instruction that this evidence is not here. The judge said he had never given a DeBerry instruction before, but he thought it was appropriate here, and he didn't understand either why the police department hadn't preserved this. So that's what he told the jury, was that they should assume that this would be favorable evidence to the accused. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those in the last minute.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Because of my mishandling of the clock, you have 4 minutes and 38 seconds, so the light's not going to be too helpful.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I won't even take that long. I did want to address Justice Holland's question about whether it was a motion to suppress that I had filed orally to have that the shaking of the test tubes suppressed or not. It was, in fact, a motion for judgment of acquittal. That's when I addressed that.
But it wasn't a chambers conference.
There was a chambers conference, and I brought up the acquittal then, but I also addressed the acquittal in court. The acquittal that I addressed in chambers was the one with respect to the dismissing the assault and the resisting arrest with violence charges, and that was based on the destruction of the video, Your Honor. So that's all I have, Your Honor, unless there are any questions.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.